Welcome to the Immeasurable Podcast at the Krishnamurti Center in Ojai, California. This series reflects upon Krishnamurti's work and how it directly impacts the listener. The invitation is to inquire together into the fundamental nature of our existence.
You're listening to the Immeasurable Podcast. I'm Leah Long, and this episode is part two of Stephen Smith's 2020 talk titled Pointers to the Quiet Mind from the KFA's 2020 annual May gathering. Stephen is joined by Corey Fisher, the former Archives and Publications Director, and Jaap Sauter, the Executive Director of the KFA. I hope you enjoy the episode.
It was towards the beginning of your talk, sort of a question and observation. And something that I think makes or points to the maybe the bigness and maybe the difficulty of what we're discussing is you mentioned the state of the world is a product of our consciousness,
right?
And so a question of that is, I wonder if, because of that fact, we're so accustomed to it, we don't quite even know, do we know how to attend to that? Because of how accustomed we are to the way the world is. So it's a matter of how do we frame this kind of looking and this question about what the possibilities are for something different, when, how do we know how to recognize what actually is the case and why it is the case. I don't know if that makes sense, but I thought that was an interesting point to bring out.
Yes. No, it's very interesting. I think the key point is realizing that the two are not separate. The consciousness and its products are not separate. Consciousness is not, it's not just a, well, the world itself, rather, is not just it's not just there as a fixed reality. It's actually constantly changing. And what's changing is the consciousness itself. So the consciousness, something to do with consciousness and matter, even although I think that's probably too abstract. It's as the consciousness changes, then it changes the way people behave, in certain ways at least. And then that becomes the world. That's then the world as we know it. And so we rarely see, I think very few people see actually, or even consider that the consciousness and world are basically the same. I am the world, you are the world, because we're generating it all the time. We're not passive observers because of this thing about egotistical self-isolation. We think there's a world out there that has nothing to do with this world in here, or is something I can mess around with or manipulate according to my desire. But actually it isn't. You know, it's something that's moving, and it's something that's moving and changing all the time. That's why I said that the simplest, humblest domestic task is also part of it in some way. If you do it in an orderly way, in a calm way, you know, that also is that adds to the orderliness and calmness of the world, at least the world you're living in. And Krishnamurti said, often begin small, you know, don't begin with the huge tapestry of existence. Begin with something very small. And then one can develop that and introduce order into things in general, but I don't think we see this gap between the two, and that's the problem. It's a perceptual problem, not a conceptual problem. That was the main point I wanted to make.
Yeah,
it's not a conceptual problem. It's perceptual. It's how you see things as being.
Can I? I like to. Because I know you were there in Brockwood when Krishnamurti was an integral part of Brockwood, of course, and in many discussions and talks. And I always felt there's a whole how do you say, a set of, a body of work of Krishnamurti engaging with students and teachers, mm-hmm. which is barely being touched upon. It's hardly any, it's not published. And and in one of these discussions, because when I was, because I was in Brockwood, of course, also for a long time, and I had access to all that material, and I would, and I remember you had this paradox in Krishnamurti's, how he talked about meditation, because on one hand he would say, well, don't meditate until you're free, right? Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, he would say, well, you know, the students have to, they need to start at meditation. And he mm-hmm. even had, despite the head of school mm-hmm. In Brockwood at the time, didn't want to organize meditation in the beginning. He would take a group of students separately mm-hmm. and have half an hour of meditation mm-hmm. till at a certain point they were doing it every 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. And then also he would say to, in one of his discussions with staff, well, you know, take the best time of your day. The best hour of your day and lock yourself up in your room and be quiet. Mm-hmm. So there's always this kind of almost like apparent contradiction mm-hmm. between him saying, no, don't meditate until you're free, mm-hmm. which he would all say in the books. And at the same time, he would actually say, no, you make sure during your day. Mm-hmm. So how do you reconcile that? How do you make...
Well... I think the first step, you know, you can't really meditate until you're free. That's a statement about the nature of reality as a whole. And it's also a safeguard against the idea that by meditating you will get to this state, which I think he doesn't want to go there because it introduces the element of time. Now, when it comes to daily practical affairs, and especially with young people, it's not different, but the emphasis is different because they're probably not used to being quiet at all, for one thing. All that, you know, particularly now, there's so many gadgets you can have, and you can be constantly tuning into something or other. If it's not your friends, it's something on the other end of the world, you know. So there's this constant buzz of preoccupation going on. And that was there too, of course, before. So I think in some sense, education is like the practical arm of the teachings, if I put it that way, you know. It's the practical arm of the teachings, and how I actually got directly involved with Krishnamurti was through that, because I had the feeling when I read him, this sounds very good, but what do you do, you know? How does it, in practical terms, make any difference? And I think he was probably himself conscious of that because as soon as he was able, he started schools after 1968, after a long, you know, fallow period. So I think I think somewhere he acknowledged the necessity for that, for some kind of practical application, and that, as you know, sitting quietly in Brockwood for 10 minutes, everybody together, was the way the day started. So it does have an impact, definitely.
But I mean, I'm asking that question partially also because somewhere in your talk that you just gave, you said it's almost despite of the things you're doing, something happens, but nevertheless you have to like somehow do things that increases the likelihood.
Yeah.
Like if you're constantly being preoccupied. If you never create space, nothing will happen. So it's almost like, so how do you see that?
Yeah, I think setting time aside, I do it, setting time aside when you're not doing anything or just sitting quietly or sitting in a quiet place, which is, this is a quiet place. There are not so many places like it, actually. So, you know, I think it helps generate something which otherwise would not be generated. And that's why I brought in this thing about negative thinking, because it's a rare concept, you know. Everybody thinks, and thought in itself is assertive. It says, you know, if you're a Christian, I believe in God, the Father Almighty, maker of heaven. It's asserting all the time. It's saying, this is how it is. You know, whereas the negative thinking or the questioning or inquiry is asking, is this the way it is? Is this, you know, it looks like a small shift, but actually it's huge. It's huge because you're now questioning the nature of reality. You're not asserting that this is, that it is one way or the other. That makes a huge difference. Yeah.
But what does that do to the brain when that happens? Yeah, instead of asserting, questioning, that you see, they seem to be.
Yeah, I think they're touching upon something. I think they're very different. Yeah. Yeah, they're very different because I think the assertion gives you the illusion of security because now I know God was the world. Oh, God made it. You know, so I believe in that. Oh yeah. Oh well, Krishna's doing that. Or you know, I make these assertions so that I sign up, so to speak, to the thing that I assert is so, and it becomes part of my being and daily life, you know. But it may be quite illusory. It doesn't have any truth to it, really. Whereas questioning opens up the possibility that I think the difficulty is that it is a kind of state of suspension. It's not a state where you're necessarily very confident about what you're doing. You may be in some kind of confusion, but you're in confusion anyway. I mean, the person who's asserting is confused, actually. But with this, there's a sense in which you're going into the confusion rather than overlaying it with something that sounds solid, but which actually isn't. And, you know, more or less the history of humankind is of building things that seem solid, but eventually they crumbled, you know. Like the pyramids, yeah.
That brings out, I think, an important distinction that we see in his work, and I wonder maybe to expand upon that a bit, this distinction between the conceptual versus experiential in terms of, because I think it has a relationship to what does it mean? Why, what is the value of sitting quietly, not doing anything or exposing what's happening versus this overlay of sort of a conceptual understanding on top of what I feel or think.
Right. Well, I think there's a period of talking experientially, you know, there's a certain discomfort in it. And this can be difficult for people not knowing. See, reification means you make a thing of things. So when you made a thing of, like, you make this, well, it's okay so far as podiums or chairs are concerned because it's real and you can use it. But once you've made an idea into a thing and you use it in the same way, you're in trouble, basically, because it's not so solid. So you have to live with this sense that it's this unease of what's actually going on. And I think that's the sort of somewhat the dark night of the soul, actually. where you're not sure what the hell is happening. But you've lost these comforts, you've lost these moorings, you've lost these certainties. On the other hand, you know, the rest may seem quite nebulous. But the journey is, Kay used to talk a lot about taking a journey together and crossing the uncharted sea. And I think those are very just metaphors, actually, because you may feel lost. And
yeah.
But nevertheless, there's a necessity to hang in there and perceive what you can. And that has a movement of its own. That quote from that talk in 1957, I actually took it from the Gurukul calendar. it's the thing that something maybe, if you're listening, something may be taking place in spite of your conscious mind. In other words, he's speaking to that. You know, sages have really, they don't actually try to convince you of anything. They talk to something else, basically. So that thing then can be awakened. That's the proposition.
Yeah, I remember, and you probably were there at the time when Krishnamurti discussed that with the teachers, like regarding their interactions with students about can you talk to their unconsciousness?
Right.
Do you remember him talking about it?
I think that was a thing that was often on his mind, and he said it with Boom too. In one day, you know, I was talking to your unconscious. So it, by which he meant, of course, he was using unconscious in his own sense, something beyond the reach of the conscious mind, in other words. But it, you know, he could do that, but the ordinary mortal can't do that. But he could reach that layer.
But he seemed to have given the invitation. He said somehow that he would somehow imply that humans can do that, right? Teachers could do that.
Yeah, well, they can. Yeah, I mean, if they said the intention of doing it, there may be some, you know, some, there may be some mileage in it, certainly. I think one has to experiment with these things, particularly in the field of education. I mean, things have happened, but it's fairly small at the moment, really. There's a lot more could be done in terms of trying to open up this perceptual framework. That's the thing. The concepts, we've done it all, really, more or less. I mean, we're brilliant at it. And the technology, I mean, look what's happened in the last 5 or 10 years. I mean, it's extraordinary. You know, what you said at the beginning, you know, 6 years ago, it was all a bit fuzzy. I mean, now you can cut your finger on it, really. So, I mean, it's amazing what these things are, what we can do in that way. It's just that there needs to be a different kind of growth in a different direction. Or I'm saying not direction even, but at a different depth. So these other potentials are awakened.
In the, you somehow, somewhere in your talk, you mentioned the collective versus the personal or the impersonal.
Individual. Collective individual. And individual.
Yeah. So what did you mean by that? Because they appear at least very different. And so.
Oh, I see. Well, I think if we take this metaphor that Kate and Boehm used, it also, the general matrix of consciousness, the socio-cultural inheritance of consciousness. It's like a stream or a river flowing. And from that, the individual emerges, but also the collective emerges, because a number of individuals can decide to do something collectively, which, you know, the communists were doing that, for instance. But it's still the same stuff. It's exactly the same stuff. It's just moving around somewhat differently. But it's the same stuff.
But it's interesting because you're saying there's an underlying, or you're somehow suggesting, there's an underlying matrix from where the other emerges. Well, the perception is like there are components, and if you put the components together, this is the structure that you have. So how do you see that?
Well, I think putting the components together is an activity of thought, but it's a more overarching activity of thought. It's a more general and, you might say, philosophical or metaphysical function of thought, that we can arrange things in a certain way, and philosophies are often like that. So I don't see it as being in a different field or being a different function of the brain. Well, it's probably a different function of the brain. It's rather something that is not determined by that, but determined by this movement of conceptualization and fragmentation, and it begins in a different place. And See, the brain of Krishnamurti, it seems, was being operated on for 50 years. Something was going on there with intense pain often. So something was being opened up. Well, it's difficult to say what. Even he couldn't say what. But some new potential, some capacity to reach something that's not contaminated. Not contaminated by time, by experience, by knowledge, by... It's in a different field. And, yeah, the quiet mind is the way into it, definitely. It may be just intimations, but...
So, I mean, it's only one more minute to go, but I mean, maybe we can pick it up after the break. But do you feel that the quiet mind is something new? If you look at the evolution of humanity, that there's a new thing coming. Or do you see... that was something that was there. Animals already have it. Humans had it, then lost it, and now have to be... How do you see that?
Well, I don't know if they ever had it, actually. I don't know if they ever had it in this sense, but there's always been this sense of... something beyond the measure of man's mind. I think that has always been, you know, people have milked for that and built temples to it and worshipped it. And so I think there's been an acknowledgement of it, definitely. But if you look at it from a Krishnamurti point of view, you would say, well, they were okay in their time and in their place and for a certain period. Perhaps they did shift something, but it's not enough. I mean, that's the yearning with him. It was never enough.
The Immeasurable Podcast is a project of the Krishnamurti Center, funded by the Krishnamurti Foundation of America. For information on our online community, programs, and how to support this work, please visit kfa.org.